Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The obsessive killing of Dorothy Stratton, the real-life murder that inspired Twin Peaks. These stories and more are told in the Hollywoodland podcast, where true crime and Tinseltown collide. Follow and listen to Hollywoodland wherever you get your podcasts.
From Liam, you love Luther Burden Jr. so much, you've talked about him for years, but he's Jahan Dotson? Question mark. I compared him to Jahan Dotson in that he takes plays off and he doesn't play out those plays. By the way, stylistically, yeah, there are similarities to what Jahan Dotson looked like at Penn State and what Luther Burden looked like the last 2 years, his 2 years ago in particular at Missouri. But the thing that you knew when they traded Jahan Dotson, what the reason was, he was not the guy that played it out. They wanted grinders, they wanted hustlers, they wanted dive on the loose ball guys, and he wasn't that. And Luther Burden has a rep of taking plays off if they're not coming in his direction. That was specifically what Quinn said before they traded Dotson, that we need to see him play out the play even when it's not coming to him. So that's why he was on my short list of players that I think they would pass on, along with Pierce Jr. and Omarion Hampton, because I just don't see Hampton as a first-round back. I see him as a really good back, but along with eight or nine others, you know, guys that you could sort of throw into a hat and pick one out, and there's just as good a chance of anybody that you pick out being the best one in the group. All right, do we have Ben? We have Ben. Ben Standing is with us, of course, every Monday and Friday. Maybe more than that this week. We'll see what Ben's availability is. What Adam Peters speaks on Wednesday, correct?
No, tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Tomorrow late afternoon, I believe it is.
That's correct. You will be off the air.
So tune in to Team 980. I'm sure Chris will carry some of Adam Peters during his show. So Ben had today, he has put out his mock Washington Commanders draft. You should read it by going to The Athletic. You should follow Ben on X on Twitter at Ben Standing, and you should listen to his podcast, Last Man Standing. So we won't go through the entire draft, but I think people are interested in what you're thinking at the beginning of this draft. And you have two different trade scenarios, so I'll let you go through each of the two trade scenarios that you think can happen and you'd like to see happen.
Right. I mean, look, you know, when we do these like team-only, team-specific mock drafts, you know, you're looking at it purely through the lens of your group. You're not factoring in necessarily what's going to happen around them. This is a draft where a lot of teams would love to trade down. I had one GM from another team tell me the other day, or say the other day, that like basically once you get past the top three picks, you're kind of looking at a lot of second rounders in most years. So this is not a draft where teams are like dying to you know, they're not coveting a lot of the players here. But obviously they're, you know, talented. They're talented players. Second round picks are good guys too. So the question though is like, how many are people, you know, how many positions or players are people going to want to trade up for? And that's where the rub is. We talk about the quarterbacks. I just read a whole bunch of things today online for different, you know, insidery stuff from different outlets, and I'm almost more confused than ever about what the quarterback situation is going to look like. So, you know, if teams are willing to trade up for a quarterback or maybe an offensive tackle, then trading down can make a lot of sense. So I went with that theory. I had them trading down to 39 in the from 29 to 39 with the Bears. The Bears have the 10th pick, and then they have two in the second round. They are doing everything they can to help Caleb Williams. Like, they were very aggressive this offseason in terms of fixing the offensive line. They still need a left tackle. Unless they trade up from 10, they're not getting one. So trading up at 39 to get one, whether that's Josh Simmons or Josh Connerly, probably makes sense. And then Washington picks up, what did I have here? An extra, sorry, Kevin. An extra third round pick. I've done so many of these things, I forget what I'm doing. An extra third round pick. And obviously, I think the thing for Washington is, if we're going to say edge rusher is their top need, which I think is fair, like, that's one of the deeper positions in this draft. There'll be like five or six guys that go round one, but there's another, you know, possibly five, six guys who go in round two. And I think they can still get that, a good player there and an extra pick. So that's what I did with having them take Nick Scorton, the defensive end from Texas A&M. I've talked about him.
Yeah, you have.
Kind of from the jump. He may not be there at 38. He may be going late first. He's not really been discussed that way publicly, but every time I talk to people privately, you know, in the league, I get more positive vibes because he is like a relentless player. He doesn't have the same athletic upside that some of the other guys do, but you know, just a relentless it's attacking the quarterback, getting after the run. You know, he's very mature. He was a 19-year-old team captain at Purdue in 2023, transferred to Texas A&M last year. They had him put on a bunch of weight. His sack numbers declined. He now has shed that weight. He's back to kind of where he was at Purdue, around like 260. And, you know, I think people are big fans of what he can do, but he still may be there at 38 because it is a deep class at defensive end. So that was my thought there at the first pick. Again, whether, you know, can they trade down? You know, we'll see. But I think in the ideal world and somewhat realistically, I think that's what would make the most sense.
Right. Okay, so you also had the scenario in which they end up, you know, not making a trade. And that's another player you've talked about for a while. So just tell everybody, if they don't trade at 29, who you think they'll pick.
Yeah, so I have Donovan Ezeraku, the defensive end from Syracuse, you know, very bendy edge rusher, had, 16, 17 sacks last year, tons of tackles for loss. You know, he might be he's a little light. He's only in the 240s, and that may make him a little bit more of like a designated pass rusher to start. But I know, like, our guy Dane Brugler, you know, thinks that his athletic traits show a guy that, you know, is going to be able to morph into, you know, more of a three down player truly over time. And, you know, he's, again, another guy, team captain, constant energy out there on the field. And there's a lot to like. I think the question with him is, you know, I need to know where this defensive end class starts to go off the board. If we hear like three, if there's like three or four guys who are going in the top 15, which is conceivable, then, you know, the Jalen Walkers, Mikael Williams, Shamar Stewart, so on, then the defensive end.
Mike Green can't make it to 29. No way.
No. I think he's going to teams as well. But, like, so if that's the case, and Ezeraku can get bumped up to, like, you know, 19 to the Buccaneers, he's sort of like, you know, when you factor in the upside, he's sort of like one of the last one or two guys in that. Maybe he's not in the top tier, but, like, you know, he's like right there. And then it starts to go into that next tier where guys like Scorton, which is a little lower of a ceiling. But on the other hand, if the edge rushers fall, which is, you know, also possible, the evaluations for this group are all over the place. Then at that point, then he may slip enough to get to 29. And, you know, again, the key with the defensive ends and the defensive tackles, teams may look at it and say, look, we like this player, but we think we can get a pretty good end or tackle in round two or three. So instead, let's take a position that's a little bit thinner, whether that's offensive tackle or cornerback or receiver, and get that guy, and then we'll get that later. So if that happens, then Washington gets that guy. But, you know, ultimately they need whatever the scenario, they've got to come away with more from the edge rusher position. You know, they've got some decent players in Dorrance Armstrong and Dietrich Wise and so on, but you know, there's almost no upside. The only player under 25 years old is Javonte Jean-Baptiste, the seventh-round pick from last year. So they need to get younger. They need to get more explosive. Whether that's in the first or second round, I think they've got to make that a priority.
Do you think – I want to come back to the edge rushers in a moment. Do you think they did enough in the offseason so far? And there's still one big swing left, and that would be Trey Hendrickson. He's still out there. There's still a possibility. By the way, what if Cincinnati goes edge in their first in the first round because the best player on their board is an edge? Then there's a chance he could get traded before the second round begins. And maybe at that point they take the second rounder because I think we all kind of feel like the price has been too high. But putting him to the side for a moment, have they done enough to be in position to draft the best player on their board at any position other than the obvious being quarterback?
I think the answer is yes, but that's also factor in, like, you know, free agency is not over. It's over, like, the nobody's signing anybody anymore. And that has a lot to do with, like, compensatory picks. Guys who get signed after free agency don't count towards that formula. You still have a guy like Za'Darius Smith out there. You know, who had, what, 9 sacks last year for 2 teams. You know, there's a lot of vets out there. If you look at the list of available players, that you're like, whoa, that's kind of a lot of guys out there you think could be a starter or a rotation.
Well, so, they're players that could be expendable post-draft that could be available that could be very interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that, like, the way I've been saying it is, like, I think they have done enough across the board that if they had to go play week one tomorrow, you know, I think they'd be – generally speaking, okay. Like, I mean, you know, some spots, again, could use more, particularly from a long-term perspective. They have so many players on one-year deals, and then they have, obviously, some older guys up to Bobby Wagner and Zach Ertz, where you're like, hey, what's the succession plan? So I think that there's those factors. But in terms of this year, you know, again, in general, I think they have done enough to at least be kind of where they were at last year, and maybe, you know, obviously a little bit better in some cases. You know, needless to say, left tackle, wide receiver, hopefully stopping the run better with Dedrick Wise, Javon Kinlaw. But, you know, at the same point, like, again, in terms of the longer-term build, they need more. So I do think that they could go somewhat, you know, best player available if they wanted at 29 or in the second round. But, you know, the edge rusher position is one, like I said, where there just isn't much upside there. You know, they got okay players, and, you know, maybe it's better than that, but
yeah,
I just think that's where they need, you know, at least just even say a cornerback. You know, the upside is that Marshon Lattimore is healthy, and that if he's able to return and play at a somewhere Pro Bowl-ish level, well, then that's a huge upgrade over, you know, what they had even a year ago. And same thing with Deebo Samuel in terms of recovering from his situation. If he's able to be look like a guy we've seen in the past, well, that's a huge deal. But again, he's only on a one-year deal. So, you know, I think it's more for me like the longer-term issues or the concern than like 2025.
Do they have a double-digit sack guy on their roster right now?
I don't think so. I was saying your producer was saying he heard John Keim had it on his podcast that came out yesterday. We talked, a bunch of us from the beat were on this episode, and somewhere in there I mentioned, you know, the one thing this team could do that would really help itself is tell Daron Payne you're going to get John Allen after this year if you don't have a big year, so he can think this is like a contract year, and then maybe he goes back to the double-digit sack guy that we saw when he was going into his last year a couple years ago. Maybe you have to pull a mind trick like that. But other than that, no. I don't see a guy that you would say has double-digit sacks. I mean, you know, Thorns Armstrong did what he did last year. You know, he had some good sack numbers at Dallas, but that was playing with Micah Parsons. Here, they don't have that. So, no, I don't think they have a guy like that. I mean, maybe Frankie Louvu, but, like, you know, him getting eight sacks is plenty good. They need more than just him.
What did he have last year? He had 8? Because I would say that Louvu's the guy that in year 2, if they've added, you know, some ability to create more down and distance passing situations where they can be even more creative with him, that he could easily be a double-digit sack guy.
Yeah, I mean, to me, you know, a sack is important, But, like, it's not just that play. It's the overall, you know, right. So I'm just saying, like, for Luke, like, projecting Luvu as a double-digit sack, I don't really – I think that's probably just, like, overstating what it really means that they're looking for it from out of him. If he gets there, sure. But it's like last year with Fowler. I mean, yeah, he had 10.5 sacks, but I'm not looking at him as, like, some premier pass rusher in the league. The way
– Well, they wouldn't let him go if he was.
right. I mean, he got benched in the NFC Championship game because – you know, he was limited to what he could do otherwise. So, you know, they need more coming off the edge. And obviously these things trickle down. You have somebody off the edge who commands a double team. Now all of a sudden that frees up other players and so on. So that's the thing. They just don't have enough guys that the other team has to say, oh boy, we really have to watch this player. That's just not happening right now.
Ben's a multi-time mock draft champion. His overall first-round mock will be out on Wednesday at The Athletic. You know, back to the edge rushers in this draft, because you said something, and I think it's really interesting, and that is, where's the cutoff? You know, which player is the last one to go that there's a consensus on, there are your first-round guys? Now we got a bunch of guys that really should go night two at some point, not on night one. And, you know, Carter obviously is, you know, starts that list. Walker Green, to me, might be the best pass rusher that's not named Carter in the draft. Stewart in his lack of production, but still, I mean, you know, people love him. Mykel Williams is one. And I think Ezeraku would be the other. Who am I forgetting?
Well, there's,
did I mention Walker, Georgia, who's, by the way, really such a strange sort of hybrid player anyway. But after that, I mean, you said that you think maybe, you know, Ezeraku will be the cutoff for that. And so what if he does go before Washington? Now we're into either a trade back, and if you don't trade back, more likely than not, an edge rusher won't be the best player on their board.
Right. Well, like James Pierce from Tennessee, from a traits and production standpoint, like that's a guy that would absolutely fit the bill. But there's some questions that have been floated out there.
Lots of questions.
Yeah. More like just, you know, how much does he burn to play football? Kind of in that, exactly, in that vein. And so that's, you know, is dropping him seemingly on the public mock drafts and things like that down late first, if not into the second round, and so he could be a guy, but you know, he has this one trait that I would, Adam Peters likes, and that is he ran the fastest 10-yard split at the combine. That's a trait that Peters used a lot at San Francisco, and you know, imagine he brought that mentality here. So if that's an overriding factor, then maybe he's a guy. But when you look at, you know, how this team, you know, targeted players last year, it just doesn't feel like Pierce would be one of those guys. I know you talked the other day about guys you didn't think would make sense for Washington, and he would be sort of on that list for me. But then, you know, look, I mean, there, again, Scorton, I mean, he, you know, this is the perception versus the reality angle. On the public side of things, he's not getting that type of attention, and he isn't some crazy, you know, speed, bendy, athletic type of player, but he's also plays very hard, is productive, et cetera. So, you know, it feels like he's probably in that tier below because of the upside. There's a couple other guys like a Landon Jackson from Arkansas, kind of
love him,
hits that as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you know, can you get that guy in the second round? I think that's where, you know, the question is. So yeah, I mean, I think if Ezeraku is gone as well as those other guys you mentioned ahead of him, you know, that's where another position come into play. And by the way, like, you know, because there is depth at on the line, you know, it may make more sense to say, hey, we don't think there's enough cornerbacks late round two. Let's take one of these guys that we like here at the top and then get an edge rusher later. Or maybe it's, you know, something even crazier, you know, Nick Emmanuel, who might be the best athlete overall in this whole draft, safety out of South Carolina, big time playmaker as well. He could be I think Dan Quinn could have a lot of fun with a guy like that, but you know, it safety isn't necessarily, I mean, it's arguably a need, especially post Jeremy Chinn, but it's not like a screaming need. Again, they have Will Harris. But, you know, bigger picture, boy, that could be a lot of fun. Offensive tackle, obviously, they just moved Brandon Coleman to the right side. So you're thinking, okay, they've got some upside there. Sure, but could they have bigger upside? Is Josh Connerly, as a first round pick, does that raise the offensive line ceiling compared to Brandon Coleman, a third round pick last year. So I think if edge rusher is gone, if that top tier is gone and they view it the same, they could pivot to another position. Also, say like an Emeka Ibuka receiver out of Ohio State, I wouldn't put a receiver as like a big priority at the moment. But again, long term, Deebo Samuel and Noah Brown are both on 1 year deals. And Ibuka is one of the cleaner prospects in this draft class. So I think there's a lot in play for them whether the edge guys are there or not.
You know, you mentioned Amon Awori, the safety from South Carolina. Just overall, I know you've mentioned this with me before, and I totally agree with it. They have to increase overall their team speed. Both sides of the ball, I would say, too. It's not just one side of the ball, okay? I mean, obviously, Luvu can run. Sanristil can run. Marshon Lattimore can run. But they could stand to increase their overall team speed. I don't know if Amon Awori is the right fit or not, because I think Starks is actually the better player at safety overall. But Amon Awori is a ridiculous athlete, one of the best athletes in this draft. But they really do overall, I would say offensively too, they've got to increase their team speed.
Oh, 1,000,000%. I mean, I've been saying for a while, like, you know, when it comes to offense, I don't really care what the position is. They need more speed. They need more explosive plays. Like, you know, they had some really creative stuff last year with Austin Eckler that got some big games. But, you know, that was not just – sometimes you just need a guy to hear the ball, go make a play, and he can do that. And somebody can do that. And they just don't really have that guy. The closest thing they had who was like a real burner last year was De'Ami Brown, who, you know, obviously he left on a on a high because he really played well late in the season. But, you know, overall, you know, he wasn't like a guy that was a big volume pass catcher or anything. But they need that element for sure. I mean, I think out of the backfield would be a lot of fun. And, you know, in terms of things they could do, you know, if Travion Henderson from Ohio State is there, he's not like a 4-3 burner, but he's plenty fast. He's very elusive, tremendous blocker in the passing game, can catch the ball. Team captain, like, he checks tons of boxes if he's available. It's just a matter of the position value. Do you want to take that? Again, they have Brian Robinson. They have Austin Eckler. They brought back Jeremy McNichols. They were fine. They just, you know, and sometimes but more than that. But they also just weren't the most explosive group. And then last year, you know, towards the end of the year, their run game just became more inconsistent. Maybe that changes with the switches on the offensive line. But, yeah, I absolutely. More team speed on both sides of the ball. You know, and you know, when you talk about the defense, you know, those Saquon Barkley runs, not that necessarily it's about lack of speed, but that certainly doesn't help. Once he hits a corner, then what? You know, can a guy make a play to make it a 10-yard run instead of a 70? You know, I think that element is absolutely something they need on both sides of the ball, no doubt.
Talking to Ben Standing, he's got his Washington mock draft scenarios up on The Athletic. By the way, I just noticed in your no-trade version, you have him taking Ezeraku from Boston College, and then at 61, you have him taking Oladejo from UCLA, who I actually think you could make the case that he could go very early in the second round. So you went edge with the first two picks in your no trade version.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of didn't want to just go edge cornerback like I did in the other one, just to, you know, do some variance. But, you know, like I said, if you told me they did that again, they have, you know, they're an older group. They don't have any youth, and you know, the upside play is there. You know, again, Dietrich Weiss is a free agent after this year. You know, other than Dorrance Armstrong, you know, they don't, right? I mean, who's around after 2025? And even Armstrong, right? It was a 3-year deal. Typically that third year, not always necessarily a lock to stay. So, you know, they need more than just one player there. Again, they only have the 5 picks. They may not have a choice. You know, they've got to address all their issues, but if there's 2 young edge rushers there that they like, both of those picks, I mean, I say go for it. You know, again, it gives you that speed, raises the ceiling of that group. And, you know, even if it is a little bit more for a 2026 than for this year, that's fine. We're still only in year 2 of this regime. And, you know, it isn't as great as last year was. They still have a lot of holes and fixes that they've got to address.
In your trade draft, the two trades with the Bears and then the Chargers, I loved the running back that you selected for them, Devin Neal. By the way, another guy, team captain, high accolades, intel from the people who report on this stuff that he's just a great kid. Plus, he's a really good back from Kansas. And then in your non-trade one, I love Taj Brooks, too. I like both of your backs. And I would imagine those are day three selections in this draft. But it's really hard. I think like with the edge rushers after maybe that top five or six, if there is a cutoff, you could probably take the next 10 guys and put them in any order. I think you can do that with the running backs too after Jenty. I think you can take 10 or 11 of them and everybody might have a different order with all of them.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I tried to look for a running back that you could use on three downs, right? Because like, there's some guys who are like a 4.3 40 guy, but just they're fairly small, not going to be able to be an every down back. And then there's some other guys who are bigger, in between tackle types who aren't necessarily going to help you in the passing game. And I felt like Neal was a good hybrid of both. My only somewhat worry is for both of these guys actually is that they had a crazy workload in college, and running back is already a position where the shelf life is not terribly long, but it is what it is, So if fourth and sixth round picks, not saying you worry about that down the line, but to some degree you worry about that down the line. So I think both those guys have pretty good all around skill sets that would make sense. The team captain part as well, just highly productive, et cetera. So yeah, I'm with you though. I could have swapped out several other running backs and, it would look totally reasonable and fine, and and address the concerns or just help bolster that room.
So you mentioned something that I think was interesting, and I just made a note of it to come back to. If let's just say Azaraku is the last guy that's worthy of the first round, they're not going to use a first round on a running back. They're okay, maybe corner is there, maybe safety is there, maybe a wide receiver is there, but it's possible that the best player available, especially depending on how this draft goes after Campbell and Membo, the two top offensive linemen in this draft, it's possible, I think you mentioned Connerly from Oregon, that there could be a really good tackle at 29, and it might be the best player on their board. I think you have to take that player unless that player, and really in today's game, these guys seem so interchangeable, right? But if there's a tackle there that they believe can line up and play right tackle, don't you take that player if it's the best player available on the board?
Yeah, I would. I mean, so there's two things here. One with tackles, if you look at, and we talked about this the other day, but if you just generally look at some of the big boards, there's a huge gap between the top five or six guys who will probably be picked somewhere in the top, 25, 30 picks. And then all the way into the third round, there's like almost nothing. There's almost nobody there who's going to get picked. Maybe one or two guys who are going to get picked. So if you want one, you got to react early. And that's kind of why I think don't be surprised if there's a run on tackles or some guys who are maybe a guard tackle early. But go back to, I asked Adam Peters and Dan Quinn at the combine, well, is Brandon Coleman your left tackle? And their response was to say nice things, but they didn't say he was. It was like, okay, clearly they're saying they think they can do a little bit better at tackle than they make a massive trade for Tunsil. That wasn't just like let's just get some competition. No, that was like, we are going all in on this. Cool. So they're moving Coleman to right tackle or to the right side. And that doesn't mean they don't think he could be the guy. But if you've already moved him once, then you're kind of saying, well, maybe we can do better here as well. And again, ultimately on offense, it all revolves around helping the quarterback. So if you had Tunsil and if they have a first round pick at tackle that they think is legit and turns out to be right, I mean, wow.
Yeah.
That's a huge deal combined with, Cosme when he gets back, combined with Biotis, that's a big deal. And then, look, Coleman, offensive line depth, as the Eagles have shown us, is a good thing, right? I mean, Coleman could be the interim right guard while Cosme's out.
Right.
He could challenge and then, Allegretti
and then a
down
replacement
the line
for Allegretti long term.
Right. And also, like, if you just look at them for this year, right, if you include Wiley and the projected starting group right now, I think there's like six offensive linemen you'd say kind of make the team. And then after that, I mean, it's, you know, the Nate Herbig and Chris Paul. Like, it's not like they have, like, guys that right. are definitely locked in or guys who are ready to be the next, you know, the potential starter in the year or two down the line. So I would have zero issue with that. And look, they brought Connerly in for that group 30 visit. I know that they've looked at a guy like Wyatt Millen from West Virginia. They've looked at him closely. He's a college tackle, maybe have to move the guard. We'll see. So, you know, they're definitely looking at it. I mean, of course, they're looking at every position. But, no, I would have zero issue if they went that way.
You know, there's another position that I think is interesting. I mean, you know, they drafted Brandon Coleman in the third round last year. They took, you know, Ben Sinnott in the second, understood. But we don't know that they're convinced that they feel like they got it right there. Zach Ertz is, you know, winding down his career. And Bates is a blocking tight end. Well, Jaden Daniels, tight end, Mason Taylor at LSU for 2 years. Yeah, I've seen him just continue to climb boards, like maybe even into the late first round is a possibility. And he is impressive. And he is an every down tight end. I mean, he blocks well, too. So do you think that's completely off the board, tight end?
I don't think it's completely off the board. I just think, like, and this is at least how I look at the world. Like, when I say draft an offensive lineman, even if that meant putting a potential starter like Coleman on the bench, and he may never play, right? If everybody's healthy, maybe he doesn't play. But you need that, right? At tight end, though, you have Ertz, you have Bates, you have Sinnott, and I'm with you. We don't quite know what Sinnott is yet, but okay, you know, just give him time. Okay, but then what? Like, I know they did keep a fourth tight end last year, typically in Colton Yankoff. But, like, that was he was a guy that was like, you know, right. If they had to make a move, you can kind of move on. Keeping a fourth tight end, like, you have to keep four is not necessarily great roster flexibility. And, you know, how much is he going to play? I mean, unless Zach Ertz gets hurt or falls off, he's going to seemingly play a ton. So that would be my only hesitation. But, yes, in terms of the player, you know, he was Jaden Daniels' tight end. He's a very talented player.
He's every down, by the way. He blocks. I mean, he's a fluid pass catcher, but he blocks as well. And he played big in some of their biggest games. I mean, Jaden beat Alabama in overtime in his junior year. That was really the game that got Jaden going. His next to last year, the first year at LSU, and found Mason Taylor in overtime. In regulation to tie it. Go ahead.
Also, Mason Taylor's dad is Jason Taylor. And, you know,
yes,
Jason Taylor, I think, owes this franchise something. He freely admitted Dan Snyder helped his retirement plan. So he could give a little bit back by having his son turn into a viable player here. Sure, why not?
There was a lot going on with Jason Taylor here. Last one for you. So you put together these, you know, two trading back twice versus not trading at all. Which of the two, if you had to wager on, if I told you one of these two scenarios came to fruition, which of the two would you wager on?
I guess I'd be surprised if Adam Peters doesn't find a way to get more picks. Now, I don't know if that means trading 29. It could be trading 61. It could even be trading the fourth round pick to get, say, you know, like the year when Washington drafted Sam Howell, right? They traded a fourth to get two fifths. And one of them was Sam Howell. I think the other one was Cole Turner. So, you know, it could be something like that. It doesn't have to be the first, but, you know, that's just the sexier option, and you get more stuff conceivably, whatever. So I would be surprised if they don't make a trade, whether it's, again, at 29, you know, that part's tough to say. But, you know, I imagine Peters is not going to finish the draft with five picks. And I mean more, not less.
Thank you. Read Ben all week long. He'll be back on with us probably before the draft and certainly after it. Talk to you later.
Awesome, man. Tip.
Ben Standing, everybody. By the way, this show is sponsored by the Team 980 YouTube page. Just open up the app, type in Team 980, and hit the subscribe button, please. I'm on live on our YouTube page from 10 to 1. Craig Hoffman's on live from 4 to 7. Don't forget to like this stream. Hit the like button and the subscribe button when you get there. Alan May will join us next. We'll talk about Caps Penguins with Alan when we return. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, the team980.com. We're also free and live on the Odyssey app. Joining me right now is Alan May. Love having Alan on. It's been a while, actually, since we've had Alan on. But the Caps just completed their best regular season in many years, finishing with the best overall record in the Eastern Conference. At Alan May underscore 16 on X on Twitter. Of course, Alan's been a part of the studio show and part of the booth with Joe B, especially when Locker was out. So good that Locker is back and healthy again at Monumental Sports. Alan's been a part of it forever now, it seems like. It's good to have you back. The season was a phenomenal one, but I want to start with something that I just mentioned, just the odds on the Caps making a deep Stanley Cup run. What do the odds makers know that others don't?
I would say what they're seeing is they're not willing to admit how wrong they were the way they forecasted the Caps just for the regular season.
Right.
When you look at it, most people had the Caps as a draft lottery team and not making the playoffs, and they're sticking to it. So, you know, I guess that's the easy way to do it, but you know, they were all so wrong. Everyone was wrong on how they picked the Caps to, you know, to do this season. And the Caps have just proved with the management team and the coaching staff they'd assembled that they made all the right choices in the offseason. And, you know, it panned out. They end up being the Eastern Conference leading team.
So you disagree with the odds makers. Tell me why you think they've got a chance to make a deep Stanley Cup run.
Well, the biggest thing, I just look at the body of work over the course of the season. I'm going to take that they clinched the playoffs basically 2 months ago.
Right.
And they were involved in every single game. I thought opening night was kind of a dud with them. I don't think they had the line assembled properly that night. And then right from game two, they went on and on and on. They were involved in every single game except maybe two until about the 60-game mark. Like, actually every period. They had the most comebacks in the National Hockey League. They were never out of a game. They were always in. I think they were a little bit exhausted. And once they clinched, it's like they've got it. And basically, they had a four-game winning streak about 15 games ago. And since then, you know, the record hasn't been that great. But then again, it's kind of like an in-season break that they were taking. And, you know, they took their foot off the pedal a little bit. And, you know, we've seen what happens when you win the President's Trophy over the course of a season. So I just think it's just a matter of, you know, they were so involved in every game, they're a little bit exhausted, and I expect them to come out firing in game one of the playoffs.
Do you think some of it was just everybody getting consumed with Ovi's chase?
You know, I actually discount that because that's all that people spoke about before the season. All the Capitals just going out there, and it was kind of a disservice and a disrespect from so many people around the National Hockey League as to Ovechkin being a selfish player, as to the Caps being a horrible roster. And I just think that at the end, because a little bit of fatigue, and it was mostly the big guys who they started to stumble in their numbers. But at the same time, you know, you had little nagging injuries pop up. When you're involved in every game, it's like being involved in every playoff game. There is a toll that it takes. But I've always believed it's better to have that lull when they had it versus right at the end. And so exhausted and fatigued going into the first round of the playoffs that they got nothing left. And I would say that's what happened last year. They were so dialed in the last month to get in the playoffs that by the time the playoffs, that game one, they just
right.
had nothing left. And so I think that happened a lot sooner because they could allow it to happen sooner.
Yeah, Montreal kind of in the same position the Caps were in at the end of last year. We'll get to that in a moment. I haven't talked to you in a while. Alex Ovechkin, 44 goals in 65 games. It's very likely, had he played close to a full season, he would have been the leading goal scorer in the NHL. Why was he so good this year?
I look at the roster around him, and he didn't have to do too much. And the way he was playing, I thought he was a more efficient. And even at the start of the year, there were so many back checks and defensive plays that he was making, and his legs hadn't looked that good in 5 or 6 years. So, how he rested himself during the offseason, how he got himself ready during the offseason when he decided to start training. I don't think he was fatigued coming into the season, trying to, you know, as you get older, it's harder to keep that playing weight. It's harder to keep your playing legs. And he just was so dialed in. And when he broke his leg, I think we'd be, you know, well into the 900s right now in the goal scoring department. I really felt that the rate he was going, he was going to break that record in January. So I just feel like it was a commitment to the team for himself to be better, to be better in all areas. But they had such a better supporting cast this year, a team that was very, very big. At the start of the season, I believe they're the second largest team in the National Hockey League. And all the additions, with the exception of Andre Mangiapane, were 6'2 or greater. So I just think playing big guy hockey, it was easier for them to play and easier for him to play and not have to be counted on so much. And then you had the breakthrough season of a Protas, breakthrough season by McMichael, and all these other players are 13 players that had career highs on the Capitals of their 18 regular skaters this year. That's astronomical. And I don't think a team has ever hit it with every trade and every free agent as the Caps did this offseason. So, you know, once again, a way better roster. He didn't have to try to do too much. They didn't have to put him in a lot of situations that he shouldn't be in and, you know, run him down of fatigue and wear him out. He could just focus on playing a positional game and just executing when called upon to score goals.
Do you sense heading into this postseason, it's been 7 years since the Cup. They haven't won a playoff series since winning the Cup. We know how much of a weight was lifted from his shoulders when they won it in Game 5 in Vegas back in 2018. You could just sense it with him, you know, when that clock ran out and him screaming at the top of his lungs. Is there any pressure rebuilding on his shoulders to go deep and contend and maybe win another one?
I would say the pressure is internal for every player on the team, because those players that were here that won it and players that have won it anywhere, it's like a drug, and they want to feel that feeling again. And you know, no one can explain the exhilaration of winning and what it does to your body with that surge of adrenaline. And they all want to get that feeling again. And you know, for someone that was doubted for so long in North America that he wanted to win, that there was so much Russian bias by old-time NHL people, and I've even heard it in the last month that where people didn't want him to break Gretzky's record because he was a Russian, and they were there were the people that, you know, when the Russians used to come over, they were hell bent on eliminating them from the ice. So I just think that he loves to win. He finally got a chance with a perfectly assembled team from management, coaching staff, and I feel like he's got the feeling, again, that he has that same type of team here. Now you've got to go out and prove it in the playoffs. But they all want to feel it. It never goes away. Every player wants to, any player that's ever been around winning wants to achieve that over and over.
All right, let's talk about this first-round matchup. How do they match up against Montreal?
Oh, I think it's a great matchup for the Washington Capitals. And the fact that they're a big team, and they're playing the youngest team ever in the National Hockey League playoffs, according to something that I've heard in the last few days. They've got twice as much playoff experience. The Capitals are huge down the middle of the ice with their centermen. Dylan Strome, 6'3", Dubois, 6'4", Lars Eller, 6'2", 6'3". Nick Dowd, he's telling me 6'2", so I'm going to believe him. But when you have that up and down the middle, you can take away the ice. Montreal likes to play a faster game, and they're depending on a very small young defenseman in Lane Hudson, who shattered all Montreal rookie records and a lot of NHL defenseman records with what he was able to do by putting numbers up this year. But to play without the puck against a younger team, they're going to force the Canadiens to play defense. And they've got a great goaltender, Samuel Montembeau, but I do not think that he is going to steal a series from the Capitals. And the Capitals, depending on where their health is, that's going to be the biggest factor. How healthy are they going into the playoffs? And once they set their mind to it, I think they can eliminate Montreal pretty quick using size, veteran accountability, and then forcing them to play in their own defensive zone, where in the last couple weeks it's been Montreal on the press, Montreal on the press. They haven't played in their zone so well, and they open up a lot of high-danger opportunities. And I think analytically the Caps are going to figure out how to play against them to create the offense inside the offensive zone and force Montreal into making mistake after mistake.
they haven't been back to the postseason since appearing in the finals during the COVID year. You just mentioned their goaltender. Just tell me that he's not the equivalent of like a Halak, you know, a Halak in 2010.
Well, it's a completely different team as well. So I look at the Halak thing, and I think a lot of the coaching at the time between the two teams, the drastic difference, and there was a defensive genius with Montreal, and they were countering on the Capitals a lot. And I didn't think the Caps played hard enough in front of Halak. He saw so many of the pucks. This Capitals team knows their best when they're creating goals from behind the goal line, where they're finding open players in the slot with one and then a second player joining at the net front. So they take away the vision of the goaltender. So 15 years ago, there was only one Montreal Canadian player from that team that's still in the National Hockey League, and that's Max Pacioretty, who's on the outside looking in right now. And a young John Carlson was around, but Alexander Ovechkin was basically the only Capital in that series. So 15 years ago, I don't think we're going to get Halak. I don't think we're going to get Montembeau. Right. And I just look at the drastically different teams that are put on the ice here.
All right. Speaking of goaltending, Logan Thompson missed the last seven games. This is always important this time of year. Are you confident that he's healthy, ready to go, and that he can be, you know, a big time factor in a run this time of year?
Well, impossible to answer right now because he has not been even on the bench yet, and there's a long time till the series actually starts.
Right,
you've got to get him in real practices, and you know you've got to be careful. You know players. And I'm not saying this Logan's going to do this, but I know that I used to do it. I used to lie about my health at all times. And you've got to be very careful that when you put players back on the ice that they're 100%. I saw in the last little bit one of the NHL teams had traded for some injured players, and they got them back in lineup, and they were hurt in the first period. So you've got to err on the side of caution with the injuries. But with that being said, I really like the way Charlie Lindgren plays. The team has confidence in him. But so I look at it not being so goalie dependent. Neither of these two guys lets in funky goals. They stop what they're supposed to. They make big saves. But at the same time, the defenders in front have to dial down. So whether it's Logan or Charlie Lindgren starting in game one, the players have confidence in either one of these guys, and so do I. I think the biggest thing when LT gets back, he's got to be 100% healthy.
All right, it sounds like you really like them to get by Montreal. In the East, give me the matchup that you really don't want to see, if there is one.
Well, I'm not going to discount the Carolina Hurricanes, but I'd expect them to beat New Jersey, and I think the Capitals in a playoff series, if New Jersey were to win that, would be able to take them out handily using the size and everything we've spoken about. But Carolina, I think they'll stumbled onto something a few weeks ago, and that's they have to play them hard. And in the past, they played a little too much checkers with them, or chess, I should say. And I remember when they beat the Caps in seven, the Caps kept making the same mistakes over and over. And it was things that the coaching staff kept saying, do this. And it was driving me crazy watching it. I thought the ground and pound game in front of their net and on their defenders is how you have to play them. Don't give them as much respect that they can do this and they can do that, so we have to do this defensively, and you can't really play your game on the heavy part of it. So I look at Carolina, but then when it gets later than that, the real thing is if they get out of the Metropolitan, then you've got to play, I think it's going to be Tampa or Toronto. And Toronto, to me, I picked them and the Caps all season long when both teams were healthy to meet in the Eastern Conference Finals, and it's not throwing shade at Tampa, who's got everything you want in a team. But there's something about the way the Toronto roster is constructed right now that it could be very hard to create offense. So if anyone is able to beat Tampa, they figured out how to get to the middle of the ice. And that's going to be bad news for anyone that plays that team.
Thanks for doing this. Hope you're well. Hope to see you soon. Thanks, Alan.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Alan May, Caps Canadians game one tonight. I'm going to finish up the show when we come back with a local receiver who could be a steal on day three.
All right, over the weekend, the Nats split their Easter doubleheader with the Colorado Rockies. Dylan Cruz is on a six-game hit streak with two opposite field home runs on Saturday. Finally, he's getting off the schneid after starting his season 0-18. The Nats have the day off today and will take on the O's tomorrow at Nats Park on 106.7 The Fan. The NBA, Cooper Flagg has declared for the NBA draft. The Wizards have a 14% chance at landing the top pick along with the Utah Jazz and the Charlotte Hornets. The draft lottery is on May 12th. Nico Amaliava announced he's officially transferring to UCLA. The deal is reportedly in the $1.5 to $2 million range, where he was making $2.4 million at Tennessee. The Philadelphia Eagles have re-signed Cam Jurgens to a four-year $68 million deal. It carries $39.4 million in guarantees and keeps him in Philly through 2029. Tonight, the Caps kick off their series versus Ivan Dabinov and the Montreal Canadiens. They're still a bit banged up, though. Alexi Protas is out with a cut from a skate on his foot. That's tough to say. He has been skating in a non-contact jersey the past few practices and will play eventually, according to Coach Spencer Carberry. Martin Fervari is questionable after returning his ankle against the New York Islanders just two games ago. Jacob Chychrun will play after being struck in the face by a puck on Friday. And Logan Thompson was the first off the ice today at practice this morning. Spencer Carberry declined to name the starter in net tonight. This update is sponsored by the Team 980 YouTube page. Just open the app, type in the Team 980, and hit subscribe. Kevin Sheehan is live from 10 to 1, and Craig Hoffman from 4 to 7. Don't forget to like the stream and turn on notifications to stay up to date on all things DC sports. And that's what's trending.
So I'm not sure wide receiver really is a first-round option. Could be Egbuke if he's available at 29. But there's a player that played at Maryland, played at Stonebridge in Virginia, and really was kind of a late bloomer as a Terp. Didn't play with Leah Tungavailoa this year and had his best season. So they were struggling a quarterback, 96 catches this year. There is a little bit of, to me, more explosive and maybe a better guy catching tightly contested balls, Deami Brown in Ty Felton. I actually think he's more explosive. He ran 4.37 at the combine, and almost everything you see says this guy is a day three pick. It would not surprise me if he went before that. Had a tremendous RAS score, that relative athletic score. Ty Felton, if you watched him as a Terp fan this year, dude was awesome without great quarterback play. 96 catches in a season in which he made all Big Ten, and the Terps struggled in the Big Ten this year. Struggled all season long. Back tomorrow, Chris Russell next.